Thanks for having me back, Tracy. Today, we're going to be talking about Hitler's first 100 days. So just to remind our listeners, Hitler is brought in as chancellor on January 30th, 1933. This is after protracted negotiations with the sort of old school conservatives around Hindenburg. Schleicher's dumped and Hitler is in. And that very night, there is already, you know, a torchlight parade through Brandenburg Gate. And political undesirables, basically the political left, the KPD, these are the communists and some SPD members, shoved against the wall and thrown into basements. Indeed, already throughout February, a bunch of what are generally called wildcat concentration camps sprout up. And, you know, I lived in Germany a long time, about 5 years, and there's almost not a place I lived where there wasn't very close nearby some truck repair yard or basement or warehouse that was not converted into essentially a place of torture in that first couple weeks. And, you know, this is what he had promised they were going to do in terms of breaking the back of the political left. So the violence starts instantaneously against the political left and against trade unions. Those often overlap. If it were a Venn diagram, they were close to a circle. You know, I want to point out the Nazis were not electorally an unstoppable force at this moment. They'd actually lost votes in the last election back in November 32. They were the largest party in Germany, but it was only a large plurality. The only reason they were in charge is mainstream conservatives were in a coalition with them. And most ministers in that government were conservatives, not National Socialists. You know, ultimately, the sheer simultaneity and newness and rapidity and sort of violence of what the National Socialists do, I think really destabilizes people and catches them off guard. And the sheer weight of it tends to, in a way that Peter Fritsche and the book is excellent, The First 100 Days, Hitler's First 100 Days, he describes this, just the sheer weight and speed of it sort of makes everything seem more legitimate, if that makes any sense. It's like, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. The real big breakthrough comes in February, on February 28th of 1933, so it's not even been a month. And then the Reichstag, this would be like Congress in D.C., catches fire rather suspiciously. The Benjamin Carter Hett book about the Reichstag fire argues, I think, pretty convincingly that the narrative they were selling makes no sense. I mean, allegedly a communist, he was not a communist, he was an anarchist. He was a Dutch anarchist named von der Lubbe, who probably had mental problems of some sort. The argument was that he by himself had somehow brought what the investigator said was an enormous quantity of accelerant, poured it all over everything and lighted it on fire, and then stayed there while this was happening. So whether or not the Nazis did it, and I'm convinced along with Hitler that they did, they absolutely benefited from it. I mean, this is their, and I say this with some caution, sort of their 9/11 moment. Now the government has been attacked, and the Nazis whip up extreme paranoia. And so this was on the 27th, forgive me, of February. On the 28th, they pass what are usually called the Reichstag fire decrees. These are essentially emergency police powers that were, I mean, basically civil liberties and due process are dead that day. Göring, who is the second man in the Third Reich at that point, had already on the 22nd deputized Sturmabteilung, this is the SA, the brown shirts, SA men as police. So the, you know, already a week before, the boundary between Hitlerian paramilitaries and the regular police had been dissolved. So the police essentially almost overnight become a National Socialist force. I want to point out that the police were already very sympathetic to National Socialism. You know, they tended to be pretty conservative. They liked the idea of law and order. A big part of this regime was edifying and holding up the police. They even create a holiday, Day of Police, to, you know, advance this narrative of them as racial warriors, protecting the homeland from racial and political undesirables. So the Reichstag fire decree means that due process is over. And throughout March, police terror is ratcheted up dramatically. And on the 22nd of March, so again, we're not even 2 months in, Dachau is established. Around the same time as Oranienburg in Berlin, Dachau was outside of München, Munich, and Oranienburg was outside of Berlin, the capital. And this is a real transition that's happened just a few weeks in from, I'm not sure which is better, they're both awful, from sort of wildcat beating you up in a basement to a much more formal system that is, I'm sure our listeners know, grows into a sprawling monstrosity that by the end of the war, according to historians' latest estimate, was made up of 40,000 different facilities. And no, that is not, I'm not misspeaking, 40,000 of these things, some of which had five prisoners, some of which had hundreds of thousands. I forgot to mention the Enabling Act, maybe almost the important thing throughout this. So the day after Dachau was established, so this is back on March 23rd, Hitler assembles the Reichstag in the Kohl Opera House, because the Reichstag is burned. And the KPD is not even present. They're not, a lot of them are in prison and they're not in the room. The building and the room is surrounded by brown shirts. So it's this incredibly coercive environment. And Hitler essentially asks Parliament to commit suicide. The only party who stands up during this moment to push back against him is the SPD, who's you know, still the second largest party, stands up and condemns him quite loudly. But every other party in Parliament, so much more than the 52% that they controlled, or the 50%+ they controlled, votes to essentially suspend the Constitution for, there was a sunset clause on it, but as I think most of your listeners know, that will not end up mattering. And then day 101, so, you know, here we are, 100 days plus one, that's when German students at Friedrich Wilhelm University, now Humboldt, it was the prototype university for every university in the world, that had been established in the early 19th century, students took it upon themselves to burst into the library, drag books out into the square, and burn them in a giant heap. And this was not the regime doing this. Indeed, Goebbels scrambles to get out in front of this and to sort of put the regime's stamp on it and act like, oh yes, we are totally for this and this was our idea. But this is pure volunteerism and spontaneity on the part of, you know, 20-year-olds, the people I teach now, destroying the literature of Freud and Marx. All kinds of things are just burned. The Hirschfeld archive, one of the most important sexology archives in the world, almost all that is dragged out and burnt. And this really just gives you some sense, I know it's sort of just one anecdote, but how stunningly fast all this had occurred and how much, you know, from a minority government that wasn't popular with most Germans back in late January to this seemingly all-powerful, unstoppable tidal wave of not just regime violence and power, but popular volunteerism. You know, it just shows you how rapidly and profoundly things have transformed in that first 100 days. And, you know, of course, that's not the end of the story. I mean, more things happen thereafter. Probably most importantly, there's the Night of the Long Knives the following summer, where Hitler murders a bunch of his own closest friends. So the SA is purged, essentially because of a blood pact between the army and the SS to sort of get them out of the way. I want to point out some of his conservative either allies or enemies are also murdered on that day, that couple days. Schleicher, his predecessor, is that, you know, the doors kicked in and he and his wife were shot in their living room. And one of the most stunning things about that is, you know, the world was sort of horrified about the Night of Long Knives, but most Germans, their reaction is, oh man, Hitler's finally disciplining the crazies, thank goodness. Even a lot of Jews respond that way. And a little bit thereafter, Hindenburg finally dies. So this is the summer of 34, if you'll forgive me for fast forwarding. And once that happens, Hitler unites president and chancellor into the single office Führer. And shortly thereafter, the army takes an oath, not to Germany, but to him personally. So at the latest, by the summer of 34, it is and I say this with all due caution, this label is very loaded, but a totalitarian state that controls all the press, every civil service organization, and is attempting to regulate life in racial terms down to the smallest detail. But already by day 101, I mean, I'm not going to say it's done. A lot happens thereafter, but there's really absolutely no going back by the time we get to early May of 33.
What was it about Hitler's message that resonated with the young?
That's an important question. Because, you know, there are a few things. I'll say, for one thing, the Nazi movement itself was quite young. You know, Hitler was only basically in his mid-40s during a lot of this, or late 40s, and was like the oldest one in the party. You know, overwhelmingly, they were in their late 20s, or early 30s. So even visually, they struck a very different profile than the mainstream conservatives, who were much older, or the SPD for that matter. So they themselves were quite young. Their appeal to action and emotion and heart over head, that seemed to resonate with young people. You know, organizations like the SA, even before the regime took power, were very effective at mobilizing young people and sort of ending their torpor and invigorating them and giving them something to do. You know, I think it was ultimately a question of how staid and corrupt and just sclerotic Weimar seemed, that the Nazis seemed so dynamic and youthful and exciting. And I say all that trying to hold back bile, but that's how it appeared to a lot of Germans. And again, not necessarily a majority. You know, most young people, at least in those early elections, don't vote National Socialist, but a lot of them do. You know, we don't have real elections anymore after May of 33. I don't even think that one was really very real. But, you know, there are plebiscites, you know, there are plebiscites at the end of the year that have 96% participation. You know, one of these is, do you approve of me leaving the League of Nations? You know, 96% participation, like 92% approve. And again, I don't know how fudge those numbers are, but it's very clear. Certainly, I mean, if you'd had an election in the summer of 40 when France had fallen, he probably would have gotten 80 or 90% of the vote. I mean, it just, you know, Germans more and more, and you know, Fritsch's previous, I guess it's two books back, Life and Death in the Third Reich, really walks you through the Umstellung. That's the word they use, which, by the way, is the word usually used for political conversion. Like, I've converted from Judaism to Protestantism. This Umstellung from sort of the before-time German who thought civically and in terms of the law to now thinking in, as an Aryan and thinking in terms of blood and the collective we, you know, joining part of this collective destiny. You know, that, and you just emphasize that. That's what the thing that they're emphasizing ultimately is, it's no longer you or I, it's we. And that emphasis on we and providing something bigger than yourself, that was very seductive to people then as now. I mean, you know, I would argue in many ways National Socialism bonds the receptors in the human brain that seem to want things like religion, which is not me saying they're the same, but they both appeal to that notion of becoming something, part of something that's bigger than yourself.